What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
This is Squawk Pod. I'm CNBC producer Katie Kramer. Today on our podcast, shots in the arm, Dr. Scott Gottlieb on successfully vaccinating our most vulnerable citizens.
They can't just open up, you know, big vaccination centers in giant stadium and expect 7-year-old people to drive out and line up outside a large stadium. They have to offer this in the community in places where people are accustomed to getting their health care, like a pharmacy.
And money walks. Mark Weinberger, the former EY CEO, on companies that have backed political candidates and are now backtracking.
Nobody gave money to a candidate or a cause thinking that they would ultimately end up voting against the certification of the next president.
Plus, uncertainty on the Hill. CNBC's Eamon Javers on impeachment 2.0 and the imminent transition.
Not at all clear now what the timeline will be, whether they can hold a trial and convict and remove the president. If there's time and if there's votes for that.
It's Wednesday, January 13th, 2021. Squawk Pod begins right now.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Squawk Box here on CNBC. I'm Becky Quick, along with Joe Kernan and Andrew Ross Sorkin.
The House is preparing to vote on a historic second impeachment proceeding, and that's where Eamon Javers is, who joins us with the latest. Eamon.
Yeah, good morning, Andrew. They do have the votes, it looks like, to impeach the President of the United States for the second time in the House of Representatives later on today. We expect that vote as soon as late this afternoon after Democrats moved an article of impeachment charging the President with incitement of insurrection. The politics on this are moving pretty quickly, Andrew. We saw Liz Cheney, one of the Republican leadership members, issuing a statement yesterday. Take a look at what she said. This sort of changes the dynamic in the Republican conference. Liz Cheney saying there has never been a greater betrayal by a president of the United States of his office and his oath to the Constitution. She says she will vote to impeach the president of the United States. Meanwhile, in the Senate, Mitch McConnell may be changing strategies here. Here's the reporting from the New York Times that landed like a bombshell in Washington last night as reporters scrambled to figure out what's going on over there. The New York Times reporting that Senator Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader, is pleased that Democrats are moving to impeach President Trump, believing that it will make it easier to purge Trump from the party. Last night, House Democrats moved a motion pushing for Mike Pence, the vice president, to push forward with the 25th Amendment and remove the president from office immediately. Pence rejected that idea, saying that that's not what the 25th Amendment is for. So now we head to an impeachment vote in the House of Representatives and a really uncertain picture in the Senate, with McConnell signaling that he is prepared to accept impeachment of this president. Not at all clear now what the timeline will be, whether they can hold a trial and convict and remove the president. If there's time and if there's votes for that on the Senate floor, all of that unclear as of right now, Andrew. Back over to you.
Okay. I have, by the way, a question that may seem insubstantial, but I've seen a lot of traffic on it online, which is, if the president were to be impeached, there's some speculation that he would lose things like his pension, potentially the security detail around him, other accoutrements, if you will, of being a former president. Is that right?
Yeah, that is right. They could vote to remove, his pension and office space and, you know, other benefits that a former president gets. It's not likely, though, that they would remove Secret Service protection. In fact, I think there was a change. I have to check this, but I think there was a change in the law that suggested that a president would not lose Secret Service protection no matter on what terms he left office. Given the sort of violence that we've seen in the country, you know, that might be seen as unwise in the Senate. But there might be an effort to remove, you know, his office space, post-presidential funding, all of that from the president as well. And of course, there's the big question, which is, could he run again in 2024? The president seems to be signaling he wants to do that. But the Senate, if it convicts and removes him, could also vote to block him from ever holding federal office again. And that would take him out of the way of some of those Republican senators who seemed like they want to run in 2024 as well. So there's a lot of politics in all this as well, Andrew.
Right. Eamon, always good to see you and get your get the latest on all of this as it seems to be so fast moving. Thanks.
The Trump administration yesterday issuing some new guidelines, opening eligibility to everyone 65 and older, as well as younger people who are immunocompromised. In accepting the new guidance, New York Governor Cuomo tweeted, urging patience because there are now far more eligible, which has only two L's actually, New Yorkers than available doses. Meantime, HHS Secretary Alex Azar said the government is changing the way it allocates vaccine doses, prioritizing states that administer their supply quickly and states with a larger elderly population. Meantime, the U.S. government will require all international airline passengers to show proof of a negative COVID test before boarding flights to the country. The CDC order takes effect January 26. It applies to international visitors as well as U.S. citizens returning from abroad. Join us now, former FDA Commissioner Dr. Scott Gottlieb. He currently serves on the boards of Illumina, Pfizer. He's also a CNBC contributor. I love states' rights, Scott. Our forefathers were smart, but now I'm wondering, were we wrong? I have no idea how to interpret what the federal government said yesterday and how that's going to be implemented in states. In fact, looking at the way the different states have approached the distribution up to this point, I have no idea which one is doing well and what the bottlenecks are in the other ones. Are we going to make any progress based on that recommendation yesterday, Scott?
Well, I think this gives states more flexibility to get out the supply. I think states were tying themselves into knots trying to adhere to a very narrow criteria, strict criteria that made it difficult for them to distribute it in an efficient way. Look, I agree with leaving it up to states in terms of how they determine distribution. And different states have different resources available to them. So they're going to be distributing it differently. Some states will turn to big box pharmacies. Some states will turn to their local counties, which might have good infrastructure, good public health infrastructure. I think what we should have tried to have a more uniform approach is on eligibility. We said on this show, it's going to seem unfair to a lot of Americans because you'll hear from a relative in one state who will have access to the vaccine and a comparable person in another state won't because the states were going to set up very different criteria. And that's, in fact, what's happened. I think there's no reason why we shouldn't have a uniform approach to how we determine eligibility as we move across states. And I think that broadening it is going to create a more uniform structure. The excess demand really is among senior citizens. That's where there's really intense demand to get vaccinated. I think opening it up to 65 and above is very prudent. And I would expect we're going to work off that demand relatively quickly. There's probably about 40, 45 million senior citizens in this country that really want to get vaccinated very badly, maybe less than that. And I think we should focus the resources there initially, given the fact that they're at excess risk from the disease.
Are we just going to have different people? We're just going to have a different group of people eligible to get it that can't get it?
Well, I think there's still going to be some heterogeneity because, you know, that once you move beyond the senior population, it's easy to say, well, 65 and above is eligible. And that could be a uniform standard across the whole country. And I don't know why we don't try to move towards that. But then once you get below that, there's going to be pockets of eligibility as well among people who have certain comorbid conditions, because that was the additional guidance that they put out. Right. So there'll still be some heterogeneity across states.
I just meant, Scott, that right now, for example, in New Jersey, it was 1A, and you can look at who's eligible, and then you look at which dates they ask you to pick to get the vaccination, and the very furthest out date says, call back, log in later, and none of these are available. So now you're going to go from people that were frontline workers that can't get the vaccine because none of the dates are open, to anyone 65. I don't know if Murphy's going to do this, but you're just switching one group of people who can't get the vaccine on any of the dates offered to another group of people that still can't get the vaccine on the dates offered.
Yeah, look, New Jersey seems to be having some unique challenges on the distribution side. So there's a difference between states that aren't expanding eligibility, like New York was in that camp about a week ago, and states that are still having trouble distributing through the points that they've made vaccine available. And I would put New Jersey in that bucket. Big state, large population, but they are having challenges distributing the vaccine. So they need to open up more distribution points. And this gets to the other side of the coin, which is probably pushing out more of this vaccine through retailers, going to Walmart, going to Target, going to CVS and Walgreens and the big box pharmacies and local pharmacies as well, and starting to push vaccine out through that channel so you open up more points of distribution. And that also allows you to create scheduling systems where you could see where the demand is, and the federal government can make more supply available based on booked appointments, based on demonstrated demand through appointments.
Doug?
Scott, I'm sorry, could you just be a little more specific in the challenges New Jersey's facing because of distributions?
Well, look, I think one of the challenges is they've stuck to this criteria narrowly. So you had to be a healthcare worker or a first responder. And so they pursued those narrow criteria and they stayed in 1A for an extended period of time. But they're also not pushing it out through a lot of different distribution points. There are some local clinics. If you go on to the websites in New Jersey, and I have, you know, within a county, there'll be three or four clinics that might be offering it. They're putting it out through ShopRite. They haven't opened up a lot of distribution points. So I think as they expand eligibility to 65 and above, which they probably will, they're going to need to push this out through more retail points, more community points. They can't just open up, you know, big vaccination centers in giant stadium and expect 70-year-old people to drive out and line up outside a large stadium. They have to offer this in the community in places where people are accustomed to getting their health care, like a pharmacy.
We've had some discussions about, I just made the general point that, you know, we want to get to herd immunity, or we want to get a lot of people vaccinated, because that's when we'll start to see a dent in the rate of transmission. And yet I immediately hear that when you get the vaccine, it doesn't mean you can't give it to somebody else. Otherwise, if that were totally true, and if we couldn't assume that eventually you're going to cut down on COVID transmission from the vaccine, we'd have to get to 100%. Because even getting the vaccine, you could give it to someone who didn't have the vaccine. And we know that's not true. When you get to 50, 60, 70%, you already, there's enough breaks in the chain of transmission to where it slows the infection rate down, right? I mean, are there other diseases where you've been inoculated? Measles, whatever disease that you're talking about, where you can still give it to someone who hasn't had the vaccine? It's rare, right? I mean, you would hope that...
Yeah, I mean, flu, but there's a presumption. Look, we need to demonstrate this. We don't have an answer to the question, which is why people hedge when asked, does this prevent infection? Does this prevent transmission? The assumption is among most people that a vaccine that's 95% effective is probably preventing some people from getting infected. And among the primate studies do show that it prevents transmission. They're a pretty good proxy. So most people assume that this vaccine is preventing infection and preventing transmission. Right. The reason why all of us, including myself, are reluctant to say that is because we don't know the magnitude of it. And we don't know it for sure. I mean, these things need to be demonstrated. But I'm optimistic that when we have the evidence, it's going to demonstrate that there's some reduction there. And the reality is, to get to your point, you don't need to get 100% vaccinated to get herd immunity. Right. We're already achieving some level of, you know, population-based immunity that's slowing transmission because we've infected 25, 30% of the American people.
Scott,
this will add to that level of immunity.
I was just making a point. It's not a stretch to say that if for a person that gets the shot, you take 100 people that are in their 40s that get it, you probably have prevented someone from dying. By 100 people in their 40s, if they didn't get it or they did get it, you can probably find a transmission to where it ends up in someone who gets it, who dies. So the faster we get this out across the board, no matter who you are, the more important it is to saving lives.
I think that's right.
Okay, good. People. Thanks, Scott. I don't pay any attention to what they say, though, as you can see. They don't bother. And I know they don't bother. You must get some great... You know, maybe I don't need Twitter. They don't want me. That someday, maybe I just won't need them. That may come to that. It may come to that, Scott. You know what I mean? I mean, my life was, three quarters of my life, I didn't have this horrible thing. Becky, thanks, doctor. We'll see you again soon. Thank you.
Thanks.
Next on Squawk Pod, corporate America and Washington. Too close for comfort? Former EY CEO Mark Weinberger on American C-suites reevaluating their political donations and whether cutting off candidates will really make a difference.
Even if in industry, companies decide unilaterally, we don't want to give anymore, all these others are going to continue to give to fund candidates who are opposed to your industry position. It's really hard to say we're going to stop and everyone else is going to continue.
Hi, I'm Ben Rizzuto, wealth strategist at Janus Henderson Investors. Is a brighter future possible? At Janus Henderson, we think it is. For 90 years, we've worked to help clients achieve superior financial outcomes and fulfill our purpose of investing in a brighter future together. We know that this means our thinking and our investments are helping to shape millions of futures. At Janus Henderson, we are committed to helping you invest in a brighter future for the next 90 years and beyond. To learn more, go to janushenderson.com.
This is Squawk Pod from CNBC. Here's Andrew Ross Sorkin.
Corporate America taking a stand in response to the assault on Capitol Hill last week. Major companies like Microsoft, Facebook, Target, and others halting political contributions. Disney and Walmart announcing they're suspending contributions to U.S. lawmakers who oppose President-elect Biden's certification. Here with more on what responsibility corporations have in the political arena and whether this is a lasting change. Mark Weinberger is here. He is, of course, the former CEO of E&Y. He was a member of the Business Roundtable Board and also served as Assistant Treasury Secretary in the George W. Bush administration. It is great to see you, Mark. Curious to hear how you're thinking about the moves that companies have been making over the last several days, condemning the attacks, but more importantly, withholding their political money from some of these candidates, or I should say, some of these politicians who sought to overturn that vote.
Andrew, great to talk to you again as well. So it's obviously a very difficult time for business leaders because nobody gave money to a candidate or a cause thinking that they would ultimately end up voting against the certification of the next president. They make their contributions based on how an individual may affect their industry, their company over periods of time, locally, nationally, and now they're faced obviously with a backlash. So you kind of have to separate the moment from the overall system of how financing is done to elections these days. And I think people are stopping because they want to show an immediate accountability for the actions taken by those individuals, and they don't know what to do yet. So they're pausing till they figure out how to move forward.
But Mark, the question is, 6 months from now, do you believe that some of these companies are going to continue to effectively fund? I mean, look, there's an argument to be made that some of these companies were funding sedition, right? I mean, that's what we're talking about here. And whether you think that they are going to return to do that, I made an argument in yesterday's New York Times that actually this could be a remarkable moment, an opportunity for companies actually to just get out of the business of giving entirely. I personally believe it's fine for companies to lobby all they want, but the idea that you can work the ref and pay the ref at the same time, it seems like a terrible idea.
Yeah, I read your article. Very good article, as usual, Andrew. I think that you're raising a question fundamental to the entire system. Nobody gave money to fund sedition. And this is the risk when you give money to a candidate, they may or may not agree with you. They may oppose you on taxes. They may oppose you on regulatory issues. They may have a view that affects the country very differently than you want to go. And that's the risk. I think it's hard for businesses alone to decide they're no longer going to participate in the system. I mean, you have other environmental groups, you have labor groups, you have others who all contribute to PACs. So it's a reasonable question to look at the entire system and question whether public funding or private funding of elections is right or not. But to say individual companies should just stop on their own, it's like a unilateral disarmament.
And how do you think just about the way companies are going to deal with, at minimum, the politicians that were involved in this really sad and tragic moment in our country going forward? Are you convinced that money really will not go towards them?
Yes, I don't think anyone's going to want to. As I said, people contributing to elections aren't contributing to politics. They're contributing to somebody who they think will help them at a local, federal level to understand their industry and business. But somebody who undermines democracy and is not good for the society, not someone I think any business is going to want to support. So I do think they'll be held accountable in that there will not be money available to those who have taken that position.
Hey, Mark, I wonder if there's a broader movement just to say, forget about this, forget about political giving. And this is a moment where these companies can say this and it makes a whole lot of sense. But if you look, some of the biggest donors happen to be very heavily regulated industries, companies within those industries. What we've seen is as soon as one of those companies says right now that they're going to stop giving, all of the other companies in that industry tends to do it, whether it be all the financials, all of the telecom companies, anything along those lines. There is some strength in numbers and a reason to say, okay, this is a time to stop and let's just say we're not going to do it anymore, especially when you consider, look, if none of my other competitors are going to be giving, then I don't have to worry when the politician who happens to head up the committee that oversees my industry, that regulates my industry, calls up and asks me for something. It's hard to say no in that scenario. And I've heard stories of politicians doing just that. Is there a movement afoot to say, hey, we're going to band together? It is hard for individual companies to say this, but we're going to band together as an industry and say we're not giving anymore because of all of these factors, or do you think there's always going to be somebody who goes back and says, okay, I'm going to try and get out there and get an edge by trying to influence more?
It's, Becky, excellent question. I don't know if there's a movement afoot yet, but I could tell you, I don't think the business leaders are thrilled with always being called up and asked for money for particular causes and individuals either. So I think there would be a great desire to have a completely different system, let's say, and how you finance elections. But even if in the industry, companies decide unilaterally, we don't want to give anymore. Let's say if you're an energy company, but you have environmental PACs, you have labor union PACs, you have all these others that are going to continue to give to fund candidates who are opposed to your industry position, not even your company position. It's really hard to say we're going to stop and everyone else is going to continue. And my interests are going to be well represented. So I think it's broader than just looking at a company or an industry and say, how do we want to really elect people going forward in this country? Should we be going to the private sector for financing?
Mark, but the question I would ask is, you know, could all the members of the business roundtable come together and say, we're out effectively? And by the way, I agree. Everything I said about corporations trying to work the refs and paying the refs should similarly be applied to PACs for unions, should be applied in so many other realms. But couldn't the business community here take a leadership position? Couldn't J&J, you're on the board of J&J, couldn't you say, you know what, we're out of this? This isn't good for, by the way, it isn't good for the credibility of the company. It isn't good for the credibility of the politician, because in both cases, it looks like both sides are trying to bribe each other. And you would think that the cost and the potential cost, which we saw in real terms this week or this last week, are real. And they're not being added into the calculus here. And the other piece of this is there are going to be politicians who are going to do, who you're going to support for one thing, and they're going to do something potentially that may be at odds with you on another issue. And in a world, they call it the hypocrisy conundrum, there's no way out in this world where companies like yours and leaders like yourself are trying to stand up and say we care about stakeholders across the board, because you're not going to be, it's almost a lose-lose. So why not just say we're out?
Yeah, Andrew, it's a fair question. But again, I go back to your point. Nobody gave money expecting or supporting sedition or supporting a candidate who would oppose even the new president of the United States being duly certified into office. And so it does go to potential brand and reputation of the company. And I think companies are going to start to look much more carefully why you're seeing this pause. They're saying, let me step back and see how I'm allocating my money and what this could do to my brand. Remember, what they're doing, Andrew, is they're pulling together all their employees' money and then investing it in the candidates on behalf of their employees. That's what the PAC is. It's not the corporate money. And for them to just say, we're going to stop doing that on issues that are very important to us, like regulation, like how our industry could survive, because we're afraid of somebody doing something wrong in the future, is a difficult decision to make in the heat of the battle right now as this issue's on the table. So you're seeing this pause. I think you're going to see everyone reconsider how and what decisions they make about who they give to, how employees are represented, what their reaction's going to be to the situation. And then over time, I think you'll see some adjustments. But I really go back to, it's hard to unilaterally say, we're going to stop giving. And because of a lot of the issues they do.
But Mark, you can do it individually. Mark, you as a board member of J&J could say, you know what, J&J, we want to actually be a leader on this. What do you make of what IBM does? They don't give. There's literally zero giving. By the way, Apple doesn't have a PAC. It's doable, right?
Oh, it's definitely doable. Companies could or can't give, depending upon what they want to do. But virtually every business asks its employees if they want to contribute to a PAC, and then they give that to individuals who will presumably have a positive impact on their industry. It is the way elections have been run. This is this individual moment in time is so unique, Andrew. I'm not saying your questions aren't a good one, but I don't think you have an immediate reaction to this and say, this is what I'm going to do forever going forward. That's why it's appropriate to pause and look and see what we should do in light of this and maybe work with groups outside the business community as well.
Okay. Mark Weinberger, it's always good to see you. Get your thoughts on all of it. It is a historic period that we're all living through, and I know everybody's trying to grapple with what the right answers are. Thanks.
Thank you, Andrew.
People today can spend half their lives over 50. So it's good to be financially ready for what's important to you as you get older, like a family vacation.
Cannonball!
Or starting your dream business.
Welcome to Connie's Coffee. How may I help you?
AARP's trusted financial tools can help you plan for whatever your future holds. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Start planning today at aarp.org/moneytools.
With the Wells Fargo Active Cash Credit Card, you can earn unlimited 2% cash rewards on purchases you want and purchases you need. That means you earn 2% cash rewards on what you want, like season tickets to watch your favorite team, and 2% cash rewards on what you need, like paying for parking. That's the beauty of the Active Cash Credit Card. It's ready when you are, with unlimited 2% cash rewards. The Wells Fargo Active Cash Credit Card. That's real life ready. Terms apply. Learn more at wellsfargo.com/activecash.
And that's Squawk Pod for today. Thanks for listening to this podcast. We hope you enjoy it. Tomorrow, Ken Langone, the outspoken co-founder of Home Depot, weighs in on healthcare, politics, and the business community's response to last week's riot at the U.S. Capitol.
I feel betrayed. Last Wednesday was a disgrace. It should never have happened in this country. And if it doesn't break every American's heart, something's wrong. It breaks my heart.
Squawk Box is hosted by Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin. Tune in weekday mornings on CNBC at 6 Eastern. To get the smartest takes and analysis from our TV show right into your ears, subscribe to Squawk Pod. We'll meet you back here tomorrow.
With the Wells Fargo Active Cash Credit Card, you can earn unlimited 2% cash rewards on purchases you want and purchases you need. That means you earn 2% cash rewards on what you want, like season tickets to watch your favorite team, and 2% cash rewards on what you need, like paying for parking. That's the beauty of the Active Cash Credit Card. It's ready when you are, with unlimited 2% cash rewards. The Wells Fargo Active Cash Credit Card. That's real life ready. Terms apply. Learn more at wellsfargo.com/activecash.